all together now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Our show today is about the future of public education. Innovative educators have created successful models of education that we can provide all children the kind of high-quality education usually reserved for the wealthy. But the push for high-stakes testing and free market ideology is undermining these models and our public schools generally. Can public education be saved? My guests today are two innovative leaders in public education. Deborah Meyer and Emily Gassoy are co-authors of an important new book, These Schools Belong to You and Me, Why We Can't Afford to Abandon Our Public Schools. Deborah Meyer, author of two previous acclaimed books, The Power of Their Ideas and In Schools We Trust, has more than five decades' experience working in public education as a parent, school board member, teacher, principal, founder of schools, writer, and tireless advocate. Among her numerous accomplishments, she is the founder and principal of two remarkable high schools, Central Park East in Harlem and the Mission Hill School in Boston, which demonstrated that we can provide all children the kind of high-quality education usually reserved for the wealthy. She received a MacArthur Genius Award for her remarkable work in public education. Emily Gassoy has been an educator for more than two decades and was a founding teacher at Mission Hill School in Boston. She earned a doctorate in educational leadership from the University of Pennsylvania. She currently lives in Washington, D.C., where she teaches at Georgetown University and is co-founder of Artful Education, helping schools and arts organizations improve practices related to creative teaching and learning. On a personal note, I wrote about Deborah Meyer's extraordinary work in my book, Breakthrough Solutions, and got to know her and Emily when my daughter attended the Mission Hill School in Boston. Deborah Meyer and Emily Gassoy, welcome to All Together Now.
Are you still there?
Yeah. I think we're supposed to be quiet right now.
Are you there? Deborah Meyer?
Are you there, Debbie?
Yes,
Debbie, great to hear your voice. And Emily, is that you?
How does the sound come through?
Sounds great. Emily, are you on?
I am on.
Fantastic. I love your book, and it's must reading. So if our listeners hear nothing else, I want you to hear, please go out right now and get this book, These Schools Belong to You and Me. I think it's one of the most important books in a generation. And we're going to talk about why over the next hour on this show. Debbie, I want to start with you. You have shown in your incredible life's work of 50 years in education that we can provide all children the kind of high-quality education usually reserved for the wealthy. Tell us about how you arrived at that revolutionary idea.
it seems obvious to me that what's good for the rich should be good for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think John Dewey said that, in fact, that he wanted for all children what the wisest and, well, the wisest and something or other. But actually, I didn't realize until I started substitute teaching in Chicago how great the difference was between the education designed for poor children, and particularly poor minority children, but probably to some degree all poor children, than the kind of education I had received. I assumed that things were, that there were certain luxuries that I had as a child that they didn't have. You know, that we had a swimming pool, and, although there are public schools in New York City with swimming pools. But I didn't know that. I thought there were things like our swimming pool and our nicer gyms and smaller class sizes, I guess. But I did not realize that the way teachers, the way teachers, the assumptions teachers had about their work were so different, because they had much greater autonomy, at least in the private schools that were most famous in New York City, Philadelphia, and Boston. And we're talking, of course, about independent private schools. Teachers may not have actually run those schools, but they might as well. They have a real status and importance. And I realize teachers at regular public schools in Chicago, outside particularly, were treated really just as shabbily as the children were. I had never been in a setting in which adults were treated so disrespectfully. And that the entire school was, in a sense, a climate of disrespect. Mm. And the idea was to keep it calm and in order so that the inmates wouldn't rebel. And the expectations, it wasn't that they were low or high, they were just totally different expectations than those that we hold for children in wealthy suburbs and probably even in wealthy neighborhoods in urban areas.
Yeah, I thought it was a very, a very moving part of your book where you talk about your experience at a great private school growing up in New York, and then juxtaposing that with your experience as a substitute teacher in a poor neighborhood in Chicago, and the shock of seeing kind of the oppressive conditions for, as you say, both the students and the teachers in the low-income areas. And I love that the question for you was not, how do I escape being a teacher? The question for you was, how can we provide the education that I got to all children? And in a way, it seems like you dedicated the rest of your life to showing that that was possible and actually indeed making it happen for thousands, if not tens of thousands of students.
Yeah, it turned out to be as good for me as an adult as I hope it was for the children. It was great for us as adults. And because we created a place that was simply very, most of the time, I think, Emily, and actually you remember it too, Eleanor, but most of the time was just fun to be in. It was an interesting place. Something, every day was different, and there was intellectually, emotionally, socially, these were lively communities, and it could, there's no special trick to doing it other than seeing that as the aim, the purpose. And which means people have to feel respected in order to treat each other respectfully, too.
Uh-huh.
Well,
exactly.
My children went to public schools in New York City. As a substitute teacher, I probably got a sampling of some of the worst situations in Chicago, because there are schools that serve the poor that are considerably better. And when I got a full-time, when I got to be a regular kindergarten teacher, I was at a public school that was really almost a model of what I thought schools should be. And in retrospect, they should have been famous, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Emily, you heard about Deborah Meyer's incredible work at Central Park East, and you were a teacher in the Boston area at the time. Why did you decide to go work at the Mission Hill School?
Well, as you mentioned, I was working actually at a private school. I was in my second year as a teacher. It was a wonderful school, but I read Deborah's book that came out in 1995, The Power of Their Ideas. And what she wrote about, you know, some of the things that she just mentioned about really, you know, the idea of creating adult culture in a school that is intended to both create, to both really energize teachers, but also to allow teachers to be models for the students, was really exciting to me. And the idea that that could be true in a public school setting was just, I realized that's what I want to do. And then the most amazing thing happened, which is that she moved from New York City to Boston. And I had the opportunity. At that time, somebody told me that she only hired teachers with 3 years' experience, and I had two, as I mentioned. And so I was so determined to work at that school that when I applied as an assistant. And my thinking was that, well, this school is going to grow. It started as a K5, right? And it was going to grow to a K8. And I thought, well, you know, then I'll get my experience there, and I will eventually hopefully become a full-time teacher. But I applied to work at the school. That was my main objective, because I understood from Deborah's book that this was the fact that, you know, what she describes in The Power of Their Idea and what she has just described to you just now, it's possible, and I wanted to be there. So lucky me, they actually hired me as a second, third grade teacher after my interview. So I got to come in as a founding teacher on the ground floor of, you know, starting what has become an amazing school that's now in its 20th year.
Yeah, it truly is an amazing school, and I, you know, feel this is a unique opportunity here. We have Deborah Meyer, the founding principal of the Mission Hill School, and you, Emily, as a founding teacher at the school, and me, I was a parent at the school with my daughter, Veronica. So I would like to talk a little bit to give our listeners a flavor of this incredible model of education. You know, I feel like I had a good education. I went to public schools growing up and had the benefit of a Yale education for my college. So I really enjoyed learning. But when Veronica entered the Mission Hill School, I saw a whole different model of learning that was so much more engaging and lively and fun. I mean, to the point where at the end of the school year, my daughter Veronica would say, oh, do we have to have vacation now? Can't we keep going to school during the summer? So it's just such a great model. So let's talk a little bit about what that model is for our listeners who have not had the benefit of being at a school like the Mission Hill School. And let's start with some of the elements of how Mission Hill was a living model built around some key principles, like, for example, the school-wide themes. So each of you just jump in here on what were the school-wide themes, and why did you have them as part of the teaching model?
Well,
that's interesting because, yeah. You know, the most essential thing we, in some ways, in this school was to educate children for democracy. And, the way the brain works, the way humans learn, and probably a lot of other mammals too, is we learn from the company we keep and the company that we imagine we will grow into being more like. Cats imitate cats, people imitate the company of humans. And we forget the enormous power of the human being to learn. It's almost impossible to stop people from learning. So if you create a setting in which is interesting to learn and a lot of people around you, instead of one teacher and 25 children, every child in our school had many teachers, including everybody who were older than them. And it makes that easier to do if you're studying things that are somewhat similar, so that third graders see what sixth graders are doing with the study of ancient Egypt, or the study of motion or light or physics. And the hallway itself becomes a place in which people are all, in a way, intensely interested in related subjects and of all ages. The adults are excited by it. When we studied ancient China, you remember, we went to the museum as adults to see a film about the building of the wall in China, right?
And some of our staff actually went to China. I think, you know, part of being able to delve into a study that lasts for 3 months instead of, you know, 3 weeks, if you're lucky at most schools, is that the understanding is that we, the teachers, the adults, would also delve into the learning, you know. And again, this goes back to this idea of, you know, Deborah was saying, it's important for children to be in the company of interesting adults. And there's a wonderful Vygotsky quote, children grow into the intellectual life of those around them. And, you know, being a teacher at the Mission Hill School, you know, when I was preparing for our study of, say, ancient Egypt, or for studying even the neighborhood around us, something as seemingly mundane as that, knowing that I had 3 months to plan curriculum, it could be daunting, but it turned out to be very exciting, because you have the time to really, the understanding is that you are going to become versed in this topic as well, and you bring that excitement to your students, and you are modeling to them very explicitly that you yourself are somebody who loves learning and knows how to do it. And you're going to help them do it as well. But I would also say that, you know, as Deborah mentioned, the idea is that we are educating in the service of democracy. And so what do these long-term, in-depth studies have to do with that? And I would say that, you know, one of the things that I came to understand working at Mission Hill School was sort of this relationship between developing the individual or allowing the individual to find his or her own interests and follow those interests and develop a voice, and sort of how that's connected with becoming a citizen in a democratic society, that, you know, there's something that many schools don't really do very well is attending either to sort of individual interests or to the common good, right? And I think that through these thematic studies, students, they were broad enough that students were able to sort of find their own way into them and pursue their own interests while also feeling like they were part of something that the whole community was doing. We were all in this, not just in the classroom, but in the school. And every unit had a culminating showcase, basically, where we invited the families and the community in, and students demonstrated, or, you know, they put on plays, they, you know, exhibited their work and demonstrated what they had learned to their families and to the community. So,
you know, it also, Emily.
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
It also meant that we had to work with each other.
Right.
You know, at Central Park East, the curriculum was more, in the elementary school, each teacher in a way developed their own curriculum. So while there was sharing, there wasn't collective work by the faculty in the same way. And it was the experience at the high school, when we started Central Park East High School, that made me realize that how much fun it was for a bunch of adults also,
right,
to realize the power of their collective thinking.
Right. So, that was not something I realized until...
The weird part of democracy is how to keep... the notion of individual liberty and the individualism that we treasure, and the sense of collective responsibility and sharing, and trying to find that balance between the two, thinking of the common good as well as the individual private good, and sharing
right.
the curriculum.
And
there were times I missed the other, you know, but being able to just. And we did a little of that. Once in a while, we had to do your own thing curriculum. Didn't we? I think so.
Right.
Hello?
Yeah, so
This is Eleanor. Just for our listeners to know, part of the curriculum at the Mission Hill School was that you'd take one area to focus on in depth. Really, the whole school would do it. And you would start in 1 year, it would be ancient Egypt, and the next year it would be China, and the next year it would be the ancient Mayan culture, and the fourth year would be Greece, and then you would repeat it around again four years later, so the students could come back to ancient Egypt, come back to ancient Greece, but at a higher level of mastery, a higher level of understanding, and go again into the material, but this time with much more in-depth. And it was just an amazing way to teach and to learn. As an example, my daughter brought
it. There's really no end to it. You could study the same thing again a third time.
Right.
And a fourth.
Going deeper and deeper.
You never know too much. You never know everything. There's always more to be learned.
Yeah, and it's learning as discovery.
From each other as well as, it also meant we could buy more materials about a subject. So I could go to this wonderful bookstore up here, news bookstore. When we were studying the subject, I could buy lots of beautiful and wonderful real books to share with children at the school and with the adults at the school. It's always that come in on Monday morning with a box full of books that, could buy fairly cheap, but with the kind of books that we don't often introduce young children to.
Right, and then the students can learn what they need to learn about math or about reading, about writing within the context of this discovery process about this culture. And I know my daughter Veronica really got into the study of ancient Greece, where she became, their whole classroom became a model Greek city-state. And they each had a role. Someone was in business, and someone else was the political leader, and she was the military general. And the teacher built a place where she could form her own sword and her shield and her helmet. And she got so into it, and it was just such an incredible, fun place to be. And I'm incredibly impressed that you could make it so fun. And students and teachers could learn so much that we parents were very envious. We actually wanted to be in the classrooms there.
Yeah, something that has struck me since leaving Mission Hill.
We also used both in New York and in Boston. We went back often to the same museum. I think some families, some of the kids convinced their families to go visit what they thought of as their museum. I mean, we wanted kids to see all the resources in Boston, but to see it as though they belong to them. Like our title of our book, these museums belong to you and me.
Right, the importance of public space and shared space.
Your neighbors belong to you and me. That sense of belongingness. Even though it wasn't the actual neighborhood, about half the kids probably wasn't their immediate neighborhood. But we were still, that's where we were located. We were embedded, and we have to give to this community, not only take from it.
Right. And what I was going to say, Eleanor, is that something that I've become acutely aware of since leaving Mission Hill is just how often I hear, like on the radio, or that I read about how, for instance, arts education is, helps students to learn their academics better, that it's a vehicle for learning academics, or that even I've heard that better nutrition in schools, like bringing in healthier lunches, raises their test scores, as if everything is sort of in the service of what we think of as, quote, academic learning or raising test scores. And, at Mission Hill, we really the learning of discrete skills was really in the service of this deeper learning and this ability to pursue your own interests and what we were doing as a community, that you needed certain skills, that was the understanding, to to be able to, for instance, do research that you were interested in, to learn more about being a soldier in ancient Greece, or, you know, to understand the scale of a Mayan skeleton that would have been found in a Mayan tomb, so that we could recreate it, which we did in our coat room, in my classroom. So the skills that students learned were as often as possible in the service of sort of this learning that they were actually interested in doing, and not the other way around. And it amazes me that this is sort of considered innovative, because it seems so intuitive to me.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and another aspect of the Mission Hill School, which I loved, was the whole culture of collegiality, mm-hmm. and the creating of community there among the teachers and the students, and, you know, even with the parents and the neighborhood. It was a open door policy, so it's not like some schools where, you know, the parents drop off their kids and the doors slam behind them and you hope something goes well during the day, and the parents are only allowed in for the parent-teacher talk. No, in the Mission Hill School, parents are respected and valued members of the community and welcome to, you know, show up pretty much any time and, you know, engage with the teachers, engage with the students, and learn from the incredible exhibits that you did from all this in-depth learning. So that culture of collegiality and that sense of community was fantastic.
Yeah. I think that is such an important point, because it's something that I hadn't really thought about before I read Deborah's book, again, The Power of Their Ideas, which obviously I highly recommend. And actually, while I'm out plugging books, I would just like to plug my former colleague, Matthew Knoester, who is also a teacher at Mission Hill School, has a book called Teaching and Themes, with chapters by Mission Hill School teachers, including myself, about our in-depth thematic unit, so if people want to know more about that. But what I was going to say is just that Deborah brought this idea that if students are going to learn what it means to be democratic citizens, then they need to see that modeled. And that was not an idea that was, you know, in my mind at all, not about in the context of education or anything else. And so this idea that we were modeling what it looked like to be decision makers, people who work together to come to a solution that may not always be what everybody wanted, but that was something that everybody could work with, was something that we really wanted to be deliberate about. But it also was very energizing. You know, when a teacher is hired at Mission Hill, they agree to meet extra hours. I think it's 5 hours a week, at least when I was working there, on top of our usual what BPS was expecting. And at first, that, again, you know, it seemed daunting, but that was one of the most energizing parts of my job at Mission Hill School, I would say, was my time with colleagues and being able to share our work and talk through problems and refine our work year to year. Again, the ability to revisit curriculum and work through it together was a very exhilarating experience. And I think, you know, it's very notable that there's very low turnover at Mission Hill School.
Mm-hmm.
At least 50% of the staff, if not more, have been there for 10 years or more. And there, we had a system in place where, you know, teachers, many of the teachers had principal training, and so one of the former teachers is now the principal of Mission Hill School, Ayla Gavins. And a lot of the classroom assistants were training to be teachers, and at least half of the teachers at Mission Hill School, last I checked, were had become full-time teachers. And so there is this feeling that we want to be there, And I think that also is something that we convey to students and families, and that's so important. And again, seems so intuitive, right?
Yeah, it's an
absolutely it important enough family that we even took some money out of our budget so that we paid people extra for the fact that
right.
If you were going to be you're going to be this kind of teacher, you deserve a higher, better salary. Teacher salaries are not extraordinarily high or competitive in America.
Right.
But
we
really only pay teachers as though for their instructional time rather than all the time that's needed, you know, that other professions, doctors and lawyers, they know that there are a lot of hours when their clients are not there that to become the kind of expert that their clients want, they need to put in a lot of time beyond the contact hours.
Well, you succeeded in
control over our budget. That was also a nice. We were a regular public school with a great deal more autonomy, and we hoped that we would show people that this is the way all schools should be. More decisions should be made close to the children, to the people who know the children and each other best.
Well, you succeeded in creating a great model of education where the teachers wanted to be there, the students wanted to be there, the parents wanted to be there, and the students were learning by leaps and bounds. And one of my dreams is to be able to take breakthrough solutions like the model of education at Mission Hill to scale. And I didn't realize until reading this book how much progress you had made in actually creating so many of these schools that you call kind of the golden era of hopefulness for bringing some of these successful models to scale, with growing more of these kinds of schools in New York City, the Annenberg Initiative, the formation of a coalition of essential schools where a lot of these models teachers in these models could network with each other. And then for you, Deborah, expanding your work from New York up to Boston, and it was all looking so hopeful then. So it was very encouraging me to know that we actually had made some progress in bringing this model of education to scale.
Yes. Well, we were fortunately naive. I don't regret that. We really took them seriously when they said they wanted that the modern times needed the better educated young people, and that they needed people who could produce a greater America and a greater planet. And so we took it seriously, and we tried to. And the idea caught on because it did resonate with what people were saying we needed about how we needed to improve education. There was also an emphasis that all children can learn this kind of. These kinds of higher intellectual way of tackling the world is not just for a small ruling class. And I found that at that period, there was that period in which Ted Sizer, people were captivated with his description of, which also came out of his experience in private education. He wanted that for all children, the kind of schools that the governing, ruling class had designed for their children. And, whether we were naive or whatever it was, it turned out that what we've decided to give children who haven't got much resources and who is what they call no-excuses schools. Democracy rests on excuses. That's the whole legal system is. People try to explain why they did things. You don't always look upon that as an excuse, but as people having a voice and explaining their reasons for doing things in life. And it turned out that too many of the people in power with a lot of money put into school reform were satisfied with a much different model and a much cheaper model. And for that matter, right now, I seem to think it'd be probably okay if teachers are inexperienced. I wanted no teacher to have less than 3-year experience because I wanted parents to have confidence that this odd education was being done by people who knew, who were grown-ups and had experienced students. Anyway, so now about the country, there are lots of experiments on how you could run a school if teachers' turnover is every few years they turn over. So they wouldn't be happy, Emily, with the fact that so many of our teachers are so experienced.
Right. I would see that as a problem.
Well, right. I think it's impressive that you had so much forward momentum on an outstanding model of public education. And unfortunately, that was coming along at just the time, as you say, kind of got buried beneath an avalanche of standards and high-stakes testing and this accountability-driven reforms. Emily, you say we know more than ever now how students learn best, but our policies are pushing us rapidly in the wrong direction. What do you see as some of the policy decisions that are making it harder and harder to have these kinds of exciting model schools to survive and thrive?
Right. Well, I think one of the most obvious ones is the over-reliance on high-stakes testing. And I guess we are hopefully moving away from the high-stakes aspect of it, but nevertheless, the aspiration has really been towards raising test scores, and test scores have become a proxy, I think, for everything that matters. And that has been very problematic because it has both made it difficult, or in some cases really impossible, for practitioners, for educators, to actually exercise their judgment and to do what they know is best for their students. There's a good example of this here. I mean, I think this will resonate with people who are listening across the country, but I'm in D.C., and there's a very well-regarded public school here that had a similar approach to curriculum as Mission Hill. They do expeditionary learning, and so they focus on in-depth studies that last for 10 to 12 weeks often. And it's a school, because of that, they are one of the few actually diverse schools because they attract families who are interested in that kind of learning. It is designated a Title I school, meaning that they have a high number of, or 60% or more, students who qualify for free or reduced lunch. And so what that translates into, as we all know, is that their test scores are not always so high. And so against the judgment of everybody in that community, they have started to suspend their in-depth thematic units in the spring when they focus now on test prep instead and the test grades. And so that's just one example of ways that I think that our obsession with testing has really has countered what we know we want for students. And I think the rhetoric is starting to shift, and ESSA has sort of, there's acknowledgement there that we have gone too far in putting the cart before the horse in terms of testing as a proxy for school quality, for teacher quality, for student learning. But I don't see a lot of examples of states or districts actually acting on that yet.
Right. And Debbie, you do an entire chapter in the book about a critique of high stakes testing, which it's worth reading the book alone just to read that chapter. I think it's brilliant. It's succinct. You've captured exactly what the problem is with high-stakes testing. And, you know, people think about these tests as a way to close the gap between white and minority students, between wealthy and poor students. But instead of doing that, in fact, this whole drive to close the test score gap has really turned students into these test prep factories, which is damaging true education. Can you just help explain to our listeners why are high-stakes standardized tests so dangerous?
Well, I mean, there are some monolith materials out that can help people understand that the design of a test, the design that we call standardized testing, is a particular kind of design invented in the early part of the 19th century to sort out who was smart and who was dumb. And their assumption was that poor people were dumb and well-educated people were smart. So they put together a tool that would objectively separate, categorize, and would be the basis then of what your expectations were for different people. And that's called the IQ test. That's essentially the same design that's being used for achievement tests. And so not only do they ignore all the other things that are important, they don't, for example, we all know that the way people talk and the way they discuss things is probably more important than how they write, in the sense that we mostly judge each other in ordinary conversation. And yet we test them without any conversation. And we don't ask them to present things. We don't ask them to defend ideas. We don't ask them to produce anything in the test. But we have what's even worse than that. Not only is it a poor measure of so-called academic, whatever that word means, academic skills, but what's worse is we have selected on purpose items that relate highly to social class and background. I mean, literally, we eliminate items that poor people are more likely to get right than rich people because it doesn't work with this design. It's just so frustrating to me that every expert in the field, all those psychometricians, know this, but it's a design that's hard to change because the question is, how do you judge whether someone's smart? It has so much to do with the culture we live in and our some assumptions about what the right answer is. Right. These are tests that all have to have right answers. And you can't argue with the right answers. So right answer mentality. We're all looking for the right answers, but the assumption there's only one right answer is itself dangerous to democracy. Why do we bother with democracy if there's only one right answer? There are different trade-offs by different answers. Taxes go up, other things happen. Taxes go down, other things happen. And you have to ask yourself, what's the purpose of it? And in the tests we used at our schools, by the way, there are 30-something high schools in New York that have been around for 30-something years that do a different system of assessment rather than standardized testing. And the evidence is that they are very successful. It's the way it changes the way they teach, and it also prepares them in a way that most schools don't for good, serious college education.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Frustrating. I mean, they've been doing this for 30 years. Why? So when we are looking for new answers to testing, why aren't they popular throughout the country? Why don't we all know the name of the consortium?
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And, you know, we're seeing wonderful teachers leaving the profession because they can't stand trying to push their students to just, you know, teach to the test, to learn how to do well in the test when they're kind of killing the native curiosity and ingenuity of their students. And so they're actually leaving teaching because of it. And as you point out in your book and other places, if you're doing test scores and grading them, you got a bell curve, you're going to have half will be in the upper part and half in the lower part, and there's no way to, you know, not everybody can come out on top the way they're designed. So, Emily, you've done intensive analysis and study on this. I think your PhD thesis focused on this, but what do you see, and as a teacher, you've worked with it, what do you see as ways to measure student progress that you think are more effective than the standardized tests?
Right. So in the book, we talk about authentic accountability, and I think that starts with holding teachers and schools accountable for the actual learning that's happening in the schools. And there is, the state of New Hampshire is actually piloting an accountability system called PACE, which really focuses on creating guidelines instead of, you know, as Debbie mentioned, having one test that has a set of right answers, right? But instead, these are guidelines that teachers and school leaders actually can use to shape their own assessment instruments that actually are connected to the work that they're doing with students in schools, and it's performance-based. And so what that means is that students, instead of filling in multiple choice test sheets, they're actually the teachers are coming up with tasks that the students can demonstrate their learning with. And so, you know, this is different than what Deborah was talking about. Deborah was talking about the New York City Performance Assessment Consortium, is that what it's called, which has been around for 30 years. And New Hampshire is sort of at the other end where they are piloting this. It's been about 4 or 5 years. But again, I think there really isn't any attention on, wow, this is a model that actually engages practitioners in the process so that, you know, when I say authentic accountability, what I mean is that there's a sense of responsibility that is authentic, right? That is not being mandated from above, but that the practitioners are actually engaged in holding themselves accountable for learning that they are actually engaged in teaching, right? And so I think that is sort of the fundamental. It can look different ways, but basically, authentic accountability refers to learning that is, or measuring learning that we actually value, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that students can actually demonstrate, and that they can apply in a variety of settings, and it's not a, you know, set list of discrete skills or discrete pieces of information that are not connected to anything, really.
By the way, Beyond Testing is the name of the Teachers College book that Matthew and I just finished in June.
That's Matthew Knoester again. Another pitch for another book.
Yeah, Beyond Testing,
great.
It's called, and it came out in I think June or July, and it describes 7 alternatives to standardized testing, which can be used, you know, different ones of them together and separately. So I urge people to look at that. And one of the things it describes is the portfolio process that we use at Mission Hill, that students must pass in order to move on to high school.
Fantastic. Well, I find your book both inspiring and depressing. It's inspiring because I can see the model.
I'm glad. That was my problem with this book.
I know, same. I'm glad we're all on the same page. I guess we did what we set out to do, actually.
Right. No, but it's so inspiring.
Remember, Eleanor, is if you're old enough like me, you know that it's hard to predict what's happening next. I would never have guessed in the 50s that the 60s, what we think of as the 60s, was going to follow the 50s.
Good point.
So who knows what's really ahead of us? And we may be on the edge of a very exciting educational period.
Good, and that's why I'm so happy you two wrote this book now and you're out talking about it, because I think it's really important to record the experience of what you created, what's still going on at the Mission Hill School and some other schools, so when people wake up and realize, oh, we actually do have a living model of how we can have an exciting model where students learn how to think critically for the 21st century, that we can actually go back to your books and go to these schools and hopefully keep them alive long enough for people to wake up. But meanwhile, I'm concerned about whether public education at all is going to survive with the big push for free market ideology, the charter schools, the voucher schools. What do you think people can do to save public education and to promote these kinds of exciting models in public school?
That's a good place for us to finish. None of these dreams are possible if they depend entirely on private education. Because, mm-hmm. When even people talk about choice, they don't mean that you, the parent, has a choice. They mean the school has a choice. And we know what that leads to. And we know it means that rich people spend $50,000 a year on their schools and then they make sure that keep the other people, the others out. So we need to, because the other institution that's in peril right now is democracy itself.
Right.
And that is part of the struggle. We're not at a time in history, if you look around the world, when we're having a lot of victories of democracy. And there is probably no ultimate victory. It's not something you finally get to and now you have it. And so I think democracy itself is in peril right now, and we need schools that prepare people to fight for democracy and provide them with the tools, intellectual, social, emotional tools to defend their ideas and make sure that the world works well, not only for themselves, but for others. And that education won't solve all these problems, but the problems won't be solved until we take education more seriously.
Right. Yeah, and go ahead, Emily.
I was going to say that before working on this book with Deborah, one of the things that I came to understand, this is part of the intergenerational conversation, I guess, is that when Deborah was coming of age, she explained to me that after the Great Depression, public opinion was really there was consensus that it was free market folly that had sort of led to this crash that had such a negative and very long-term impact on the country. And so that was really the idea of free markets being something that was synonymous with democracy was really a foreign idea at that time. It was sort of a fringe idea. I came of age in the 80s during the Reagan Revolution, and so that was what I understood was like that. That was when those ideas came back, I think, with great force, and we're really living them now. And so what I would say is that hopefully we're going to shift away from that again, and that's what really needs to happen, because I think we can't think of public education as a commodity that can be bought and sold for profit. It can't be. We can't have schools that are left to fail or tank based on conditions. Schools serve children and they serve communities, and ultimately they serve our democracy. And that's why they have to remain in the public domain, and they have to remain free and open to all comers. And they need to keep the interest of children and not shareholders at the forefront. And I think that's, again, such an obvious idea that schools should not be for profit. But I think this, in turn, will require a shift toward thinking of democratic values and practices as something that needs to be more deliberately taught and modeled in schools. And I'm not sure if that's ever been something that we have done, but it's something that I know now after working at Mission Hill School and working with Deborah is possible, and that, as Deborah mentioned, there are models that we should be looking at, including the Mission Hill School, again, in its 20th year now, and going strong. And, you know, democracy is not something, as Deborah has written about and spoken about for a long time, is not something that necessarily comes naturally to us. And so where else would we learn it but in our public schools? And so I think those are the shifts that really need to happen if we are to really see improvement in our public, or where our public schools are to survive, really.
Right.
You know,
well,
Emily,
yes.
The school I went to, the private school I went to, was started in the late 19th century to be a working men's school to teach working men how to build a democratic economy, cooperative.
Right.
And it was so popular with working men that rich people decided it might be good for them, too. And, of course, by the time I went there, there were very few working men's children. But a lot of those models, a lot of the interesting things going on in education today were started by people who were trying to figure out a system of education for working men and the poor. And they got taken over by the rich.
Yeah. Right, Montessori, Waldorf, Reggio Emilia.
yeah,
all of those started as models for working class children. And I think that's a really important point perhaps that we should end on, is that even people who I think of themselves as liberal or enlightened, I am shocked when people say, well, progressive education is good for, you know, kids who can handle it, meaning kids from middle class and wealthy families. And I think that's amazing, because kids who, even if you think that they don't get that kind of education at home, then that's all the more reason why schools should provide it, right, for all students. But again,
exactly.
As Mission Hill and many other schools have shown, it's completely possible.
It is so possible, and that's a great note to end on. That's all the time we have.
Okay.
The book is These Schools Belong to You and Me. I encourage our listeners to go out and read the book, see if what you can learn about great models of education and how to save public education. Deborah Meyer and Emily Gassoy, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you,
thank
Eleanor.
And our love to Veronica.
Yes, I'll let her know.
Who was in my class, in fact. So
yes,
exciting.
Amazing.
All right. Thanks, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.